Stoned Oak here, and I'm a little confused. You see, I'm looking at this book, Only Revolutions, and I don't understand why the text is upside down. It must have been printed this way by mistake. I've written a letter to Random House, pointing out that many readers are likely to be asking for refunds, but I haven't heard back from them. Do they actually want to sell books? Are they fools? Most distressingly, our young roving correspondent failed to ask Mark Danielewski about this, and I'm beginning to have my doubts about his interviewing skills.
Hi, I'm here with Mark Z. Danielewski, author of recently Only Revolutions as well as House of Leaves. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, first off, let's go ahead and get the boilerplate, you know, interview question out of the way. How was this book conceived? What came first? The Sam's perspective, the historical timeline, or...
It all came at once.
Really?
It was a lightning bolt for me. But its origins were two kids that I'd seen a long, long time ago who were impertinent, parentless, homeless, begging for change on a corner, both of them around 16, and yet madly in love with each other. They just snarled and barked at the world around them, but they were completely, you know, beholden to each other. And I remember just how much that moved me. And then one day I passed the corner where they were begging for change, and they disappeared. And I always wondered where they went. And in a way, I saw them in different forms wherever I was, whether I was in Paris, whether I was in the Bowery in New York, or on Telegraph in Berkeley. And, you know, we've all seen those two kids. We've maybe been those two kids to a certain degree. So that story was always in my head. And, you know, we could get into sort of the peculiarities of why it's, I think, a particularly American tale. But what I conceived of in the writing of it immediately was that the book could actually physically enact the relationship that you would start on both sides of the book with him and with her at the same time, and they would be far apart from each other. And then slowly, as you marched through the book, they would get closer and closer to finally seeing each other, understanding each other, and legitimately loving each other. Until at the very center, they would actually touch. You know, there would be an equality in their relationship, a balance. And then, as they moved away, they would actually start to get farther and farther apart. And you would feel that tugging physically of moving away from the other person. And that all assembled itself rapidly in my head. But, of course, bringing it to fruition, all the details that were part of that entire story, conception, you know, character piece, where it was incredibly complicated.
Well, Haley, as has been universally observed, also appeared briefly in House of Leaves as one of Johnny Truant's conquests.
Yeah.
However, there's something very peculiar about that appearance that I want to talk to you about,
right,
in the sense that you remark upon the twist of her wrists.
Right.
I'm wondering if Haley had been gestating during the sort of latter part of House of Leaves, or...
Well, I saw these two kids... definitely long before I started House of Leaves. I didn't know that I was going to write the story about them. It was almost like, as I've mentioned before, they were ghosts to me. As much as I don't believe in ghosts, this book began with two ghosts, because I began to see them around. And certainly when I was on tour for House of Leaves, and then on tour with my sister with Depeche Mode, I encountered hundreds and hundreds of kids who would then tell me their particular stories and whatnot. Certainly at the very end of House of Leaves, I was already starting to twist this story around in my head. And let's just leave it at that.
Okay, I know you're not a man who likes to reveal too much here. Well, actually, I wanted to talk about the vernacular of the book, which is somewhere between Chaucer and hip-hop to some degree. For example, all always appears as double L's, like for always and the like. I wanted to talk to you about, like, I mean, there's very specific things, like Snugglepup.
Sure.
Which is, like, you know, a very particular form of flapper slang, which I was very proud to look up. Yeah, very pertinent, too. I'm wondering, though, because a lot of this is invented words versus kinds of really obscurant kind of words. What was the kind of, you know, what, did you set any kind of rules as to what types of words you would use to go ahead?
Absolutely. I mean, it was very, very concrete. And in fact, you know, hats off for recognizing, you know, some of what's going on there. The there are actually not as many made-up words as you would think. In keeping with the story of these two outcasts, and we have to look a little at what an outcast is. I mean, today we look at them as someone who has not been able to make it in society. If we go back to classical times, to Homeric times, it was the same thing, but one always looked and wondered if Zeus was sitting there on the corner, or Mars and Aphrodite were in fact there at the back of the tavern. You know, there was always that sense with the outcast that they could be the deities that ruled the machine in a way. And certainly that resonates throughout in this book. Interestingly enough, the vocabulary itself, I discovered, was outcast. You can go to your Oxford English Dictionary, you can go to your Webster's, and you will not find a lot of these words. I ultimately had to go to old songs. I found pamphlets of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the turn of the century, that had different vocabularies that was specific to teenage slang. It was the music, their idiom, that wonderful period in life where kids are willing to make up words, words that may never get canonized in a dictionary. So there was a great deal of research, and it was specific to being a teenager. Like, just recently I overheard, because I still a little am in only revolutions mode, some teenagers talking, and they used the word frixon, and that was an amplifier, basically. That's frixon sexy, or that's frixon, you know, bust, or, you know, whatever. And it was just suddenly, it was one of those words that just popped into my head. Now we can kind of look at all sorts of, like, that's blown up, that's fresh, that's, you know, you can keep going all the way back down to, you know, or fly, for instance, which came around in hip-hop time, but was actually around in the 30s and 40s, you know. So there were a whole series of vocabulary words that really reflected that teenage willingness to play games, to have fun, to court one another, and to kind of step outside of the norm of what language was being used in their particular time.
I was curious if you were familiar with Gene Wolfe's work, because it reminded me very much of that. Gene Wolfe, he wrote these great sort of books about this torturer, and it was, you know, oddly enough, similar to sort of the kind of revolutionary fervor in this book. But he also, in an effort to kind of evoke a different time, looked for far and wide for really, really obscure language, you know?
I'm not. I will check him out. It's that's wonderful. It is a he?
Gene Wolfe.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think Anthony Burgess, in some sense, you know, of Clockwork Orange and that kind of that world.
I did see Esquilin pop up. Yeah,
of course. You know, so there was a bit of that, too. But I think at a certain point there was an engagement with how language lifts off the page. It lifts off from those reference books that we have. You know, it suddenly starts to mingle in the air, and it's on the street and on the road, and it's really that private language of teenagers, of developing on their own vocabulary for how they feel, and it's far more intimate. And certainly the language constantly challenges you. It spars with you. It tells you to keep away, man. You don't understand what I'm talking about. And yet at the same time, because you have both versions, that haze that it creates, that quantum haze of sort of the same thing being told, does actually reveal the meaning, I think, within.
I was curious, because both this book and House of Leaves deal with a very explicit and specific structure. Do you need such a structure to kind of confine yourself as a writer? I mean, the sense I'm getting based off of your description of language is that you're a guy who likes to play when you write. And I'm wondering if sort of structure and having like a 360-page structure, 8 pages each set, 45, you know, sections apiece, is this a way for you to kind of, I guess, control the impulse to play too much? Or?
Well, it's a very keen question, because in the case of Only Revolutions, it was one of the key central themes concerns liberty and love, and that particular relationship, and how love in some ways sacrifices liberty, and liberty can sometimes in a way sacrifice love, and are they exclusive? So for me, it's here are these two kids that are on the road, that they're going for freedom. You know, they're gonna speak in the idiom of free verse, if you want, and yet What I wanted to do is kind of entrap them in a structure and then have them physically vie against it. So for me, it's a prolonged kind of wrestling match with that. You can say it's free verse, but at the same time, their words are concurrent with each other as well as what happens later on on the opposite side of the page. So it's actually each word exists in four places. So obviously it would be Sam beginning is Haley beginning, but Haley beginning is Sam end and Sam beginning is Haley end. And so that's not as free anymore, you know? So it was this constant wrestling match between how to break free of those bonds, and yet at the same time you kind of get pulled back into the bonds, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I'm wondering if you had sort of like, you know, you had sort of blank spaces as you were kind of drafting this as to what text to place exactly in that kind of thing, because you're also dealing with a historical timeline, which we haven't even touched upon.
Right. In some ways, there was finally for the fifth draft, or the fifth version, if you will, there was a map that I created that literally fit on one page. It had all the dates. It was 360 boxes. I love that. We just got the skateboard scene.
Yeah,
The skateboard scene with where Haley is, you know, in the pool and all of that. And I was just thinking, for the audiobook, we had to get a skateboard sound. And I was just listening to it and going, I wonder if we could get that. Maybe I could. So I had this whole map, and I really knew what was happening on each page pretty closely. You know, it certainly was broken down almost like a storyboard, if you will. So it wasn't quite what you were pointing at, but there was certainly a specificity that I knew the creep was going to appear on such and such a page, and that encounter would be in three pages, or four pages, and so that would be four boxes, and I'd kind of know what the arc was in there. And whatnot, yeah.
It's almost like a three-act structure in a screenplay, actually. And I actually wanted to sort of touch upon the role of film that plays throughout your work. You've actually worked on films.
Yeah.
I know you actually did sound for a Derrida.
That's correct.
Derrida documentary, as well as you appeared in Gettysburg.
Gettysburg, yes.
what is it, I mean, is film sort of a very helpful kind of point for you to kind of rekindle the visual inspiration? Because, of course, your work is also all visual as well.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, for me, it, you know, whenever I talk to young writers, which I've done recently a little in the start of this tour, you know, they ask me my advice on writing, and I think it holds for anything that's creative, which is write what you love, because that holds you through the hard times. And it then follows that if you love something, you're going to get to know something. So it actually kind of gets back to write what you know. But it starts in a slightly different place. I just love movies. I love going to movies. You know, I've always watched movies. You know, my father used to bring movies home. We would screen them in the basement from a 16-millimeter projector. Between reel changes, we would discuss them. You know, so visually, you know, it's a world that I'm just always immersed in, and I really enjoy. I think there is a kind of tension in this particular book because so much of it is musical in a way, and yet it is visual, and yet it's not visual, because you read this and you have a sense, you personally have a sense of what Haley and Sam look like. And yet Sam and Haley are all races. They are all facial structures. They are all, you know, an ever-shifting continuum of fashion, and you really can't visualize that, and yet you can. Your mind can hold all those various states and ultimately distill it down to one sense of Sam and one sense of Haley. And so for me, it's I guess, to get at the root of what your question is, it's not so much as just approaching what's visual, but getting at what is really visual? What are we really seeing? Trying to see beyond the way we see now. And I think books in general offer us, or can offer us, a type of vision which is beyond even the reach of light.
Well, I mean, I thought the film comparison particularly apt because of the sort of the little dots that reminded me of reel changes, which I've been pulling my hair out trying to figure out what the hell these things are. At first, I kind of thought, they symbolize a generation, or they seem to come when the creep actually comes in, and I know I'm not going to get an answer from you.
You're absolutely
right. Can you provide any kind of hint for us, or...
I think you're doing just fine. You know, I mean, I think it was interesting you brought up the act structure. You certainly can look at it as a three-act structure, but I actually viewed it as a five-act structure. and it, which still holds, because a three act is in essence one act, three acts, and one act, you know, where in this case I did look at it as five acts, and you know, that certainly the amount of time that takes for each five acts, it's 72 pages. If you started to really process minutes, I don't know, I like it.
Well, I wanted to actually, fonts are obviously a big thing in both of the books, mm-hmm. and I wanted to, you know, ask you about, like, you know, do you think that there's actually, this actually comes from a sort of like a little argument I saw in the blogosphere on conversational mm-hmm. reading, where people were arguing that, oh, Daniel Levski's not experimental because all he does is like fiddle with the fonts and fiddle with the typography, and turning a book around in a 45 or a 180 degree angle, that's not experimental. Hmm. Do you consider yourself an experimental writer, and in terms of like shifting the reader experience directionally and visually? I mean, maybe you can sort of tie this into that answer.
No, I don't think I'm an experimental writer. I don't really know what that means, in fact, an experimental writer. For me, it's always an exploration, you know. I just can't help but think, you know, when you experiment, you're kind of tinkering. And this is such a prolonged investigation, you know. You don't tinker for 6 years, you know. It's a long, you know, quest to see where something goes. And the thing I'm, you know, the thing I really stand by is that it's, you know, I fulfilled the qualities of Sam and Haley's journey. Now, whether it's a success or not, it's clear what it is. It's not halfly done. It's wholly spinningly done, you know. And you can either say, I don't care for it, or you can recognize that, wow, if we follow this path to its, at least maybe not its conclusion, but a long way, this is kind of where it ends up going, and these are the things you get out of it, and these are the things you don't get out of it, you know. And that creates, I think, a valid type of conversation. The interesting thing to me is, I think still a lot of people haven't read the book. It takes a while to get into it. As we were speaking a little earlier, you managed to let go, I think, of some of your preconceptions of reading and move rapidly through it. I encountered a 17-year-old girl who said, to hell with everything else, and just read Haley, didn't read the history, and consumed it in three days, and her father said that she was in tears by the end. You know, so that was the way she got at it, which was, you know, the way I would expect a teenager to get at it, in a way, of being free to jettison historical things. My point being that still a lot of people are looking at the case art, at the ribbons, that the upside down text and the colored O's. They think that's what the conceit is. What is really at work, and it's the thing that that has been brought up recently on tour, and I think other people have mentioned it because I think it's the most arrogant thing I've ever said, which is that it requires a different academic math, this book. And I'll be very pointed about that, because it's not to say that's a good thing or not. It just means it's a different thing. And if you can point to a particular book that does this, that's great. Which is, every word exists in four different places. So if we look at one, there's one page where Haley, for instance, is bringing forth spring in the very beginning. And she beholds the mountain. And the mountain hails her and says, she. And it echoes down around her. And this is, you know, her vast projection upon the natural world around her. Well, if you look at the page beneath, the upside down text, we're now reaching Sam's conclusion. And I'm not going to say what happens or how they get there, but now suddenly it's a mountain. And it's not a fiery mountaintop. It's an ice enclosed place. And we don't know what's happened to Haley, but Sam is holding her, and what he says is she. And that she is exactly at the same place that the she is above where Haley hears it on the mountain. So who is really saying she? Is it her or is it him? And is that word carrying across the pages, and if you'll excuse the rhyme, the ages, this book? So, and then that happens in two other places. So now you're dealing with a text that really doesn't exist on one page. It exists in four different places at the same time. And how do you begin to analyze that? How do you parse that? Just like just like quantum physics required its own series of equations to examine, you know, that was very different from the macro universe. I believe that there isn't the nomenclature yet to address that on an academic level.
I'm just curious, though, in terms of, like, every novelist who writes has some element of, like, you know, unconscious ambiguity,
mm-hmm.
Or unconscious meaning that kind of creeps into their work or that creeps into the text. Now, something as just rigorously structured as this, do you feel that, you know, that there is ambiguity there that you don't know about? I was looking actually at the Only Revolutions website, and there are all these people who are arguing like crazy over what the book means.
Right.
And I'm wondering, though, you know, since you're such a, you know, obviously kind of crazed planner, I mean, you can't necessarily plan everything, or do you feel that you have? Or do you feel that there's no room for any unconscious ambiguity? Or is, if you'll pardon my third question, you know, there's just simply, you know, you're trying to whack down the unconscious ambiguity so that it's all, you're very well aware of it.
Oddly enough, I think there's probably more ambiguity in this book than there is in House of Leaves. House of Leaves, I actually could see how the book could be interpreted, because for me, it's a journeyman's piece. It's a piece that holds very tightly to a lot of great predecessors, whether it's Plath or Joyce or Pynchon, Nabokov, Borges. I mean, they're very specific modes of literature that I was very well aware of, and I was well aware of how those particular pieces would be interpreted or treated. In this book, because I can't find the obvious reference, the obvious precursors, it becomes a lot more difficult for me to see how it's interpreted. And so, you know, it's a book that actually makes me feel very vulnerable and very exposed. I don't necessarily know how it will be treated or held or handled. I ultimately don't know how people will write about it. And yet that was something that was important to me when I wrote it. I wanted to go beyond what I could plan, what I could foresee. I wanted to make chess moves that I didn't, that I couldn't foresee the answer to. You know, I wanted to, in a way, further the dialogue, the way a musician might throw out a riff that is unheard of, and suddenly, wow, you have to respond. Like, how am I going to handle that riff that just came my way, that has a different meter, a different key, a shifting key, and suddenly you answering it isn't the same old, you know, blues and B. I mean, it's... So I think that's kind of where I'm at.
I'm wondering if the time of preparation for this book, as opposed, I mean, everyone knows about the legendary story of you holding up at a Random House Carol for 3.5 weeks to go ahead and typeset,
sure,
you know, House of Leaves. I'm wondering if the additional time you had for this, do you feel that, you know, the urgency that was there in House of Leaves, do you think any of that translated into having this kind of additional time of sitting and laying out all the pages in a ballroom or what?
Well, there still was, you know, there was an urgency finally in the end. You know, I didn't have to go to that ballroom. I mean, we were making corrections. At a certain point, it was slated. It was heading to the press, and everything had to be done. And so, you know, at that stage, I could have easily stepped back and said, no one's going to notice these details. And instead, I go and spend a day in a ballroom and, you know, and start cross-checking and whatnot. The thing about the typesetting is with this one, it was far more continuous. It was far more concurrent. I was constantly working at the same time with Pantheon. I would email Peter Anderson and go over fonts, or Andy Hughes and talk about where how the ink was going to register. And you know, even the folio was carefully designed. You know, we have these rotating page numbers, right, within the big circle. Well, originally I had those two circles touching, which for me, you know, it enforced the idea of eight and infinity, and yet it was rotational and all of that. But then in a further discussion with Peter, we sort of said, well, what if we nudge those apart? You're still going to get the implication of the infinity and the eight, and yet at the same time, it's a little more accurate in reflecting the distance that is still inherent between these two characters, and the question of maybe they aren't infinite. Maybe they are just zero, you know? And so that was just the amount of time that went into that little nudge, that little 16th of an inch there. And that was a little under the gun as well. But there's no question it was different, you know? I mean, House of Leaves was reflected a certain time in my life. The conditions were different. This is reflects a different time as well. So I probably don't have enough perspective yet to answer that fully.
Well, it's interesting that sort of story about Infinity in light of the left wrist twist that frequently pops up throughout the book.
Sure.
Where did that come from? I mean, it seems to me to clearly, I mean, I don't expect you to answer, but to me it seems very clear that it represents some kind of Infinity. And of course we have two circles conjoining together, well, you know, obvious sort of love story. But then you tell me this story of this 16th inch, and I'm wondering, I mean, you know, irrespective of my interpretation, where did the left wrist twist idea kind of come from? Because again, it kind of points back to the House of Leaves. There's a twist cited in that little reference.
I wonder where that left wrist twist came from. I mean, think about it. What normally sits on a left wrist?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, circles. Well, circles. I mean, when did the circle come into play?
Well, more than just circles, yeah. Right? I mean, what's sitting on my left wrist?
Yes, I see.
So, you know, the circle. For me, it's John Hollander, who was a professor of mine in college, was is an esteemed poet, and he wrote a wonderful, has written several wonderful books of poetry, and also has described certain poetic modes, whether it's, you know, the formal villanelles or sonnets or whatnot. And one of the things that he actually said was the weakest form of poem is that which begins the way it ends. So it's completely circular, right? And yet we do follow cycles. We all know that, you know? So for me, it was interesting to explore how something could be circular, the way, say, Finnegan's Wake is, right? And yet at the same time, not circular. And I think that is one of those dissonances that we are constantly handling, perhaps unconsciously, of where, okay, there's the cycle of life and birth, you know? I mean, life and death, birth and, you know, and passing on and going. And yet at the same time, we can see that ad infinitum, you know? And yet at the same time, we also realize that there will be a future without us. So we exist in a finite line, and yet we exist in a circle. So as circular as the book is, it's also very finite. And that was that point of exploration of what is unique and what is not unique. Every teenager at one point has had an intense emotional experience, whether it was fulfilled or rejected, a crush, you know, a small relationship, a long relationship. We've all had that very intense experience. And every time we feel that no one else could understand it, and it is unlike anything else out in the world. And as you grow older, you start to realize that everyone had it, right? And we got over it for the most part. Maybe we were scarred a bit, and maybe we can even laugh about it, right? But those two states exist. We're right as adults, and we're right as teenagers. They are an experience that cannot be reproduced anywhere else, you know? That it is personal and intimate to only you. The love that you feel for that one other person that is beyond your family, beyond your educational system, your social, your cultural, that first flinging of yourself out towards another is so particular and yet so recurrent.
There's one. We gotta wrap this up soon, but there's one last question I wanted to ask you, and that was about this notion of love and liberty and this kind of thing. Well, you know, we were talking about what the twist might be,
sure.
But there's something that I found very interesting about this book, and that was that the love or the sort of pining or the connection with historical events. I mean, the sensation of actually looking at like your watch or paying attention to time when you realize that you will not die, this was kind of buried in comparison to the sort of like, you know, the kind of rolling around in the constantly changing car or rolling around for the sake of love. Why was that sort of prioritized over, I guess, this kind of, you know, what it is to be immortal, which is, Jesus Christ, I you know, what does time mean? What do the kind of rules that the mere mortals kind of follow mean? And, you know, when these mortals, they go, they don't expire, for example.
Right. Well, I think what you're bringing up there is sort of that that mature notion of analysis, of when you actually start to reflect upon something. And Sam and Haley really don't reflect. They don't mull over things. They almost don't have memories, in a way. They live constantly presently. And what they, the only thing they reflect upon is the other. They see themselves through the other. And what makes them enticing and terrifying at the same time is the way they completely neglect the history they incarnate, or the history they disregard, or the history they influence. They just are these, you know, mighty creatures, if you will, that stride through history without a real care, except for each other. They don't care that cities are burned to the ground, or you know, hurricanes have wiped out entire coastal regions, or political events have created, you know, new sort of situations in various nations and whatnot. So, that whole question of reflection and observation and examination of history is very, I think, important to perhaps this country, if you want to get down to what is, you know, the political nature, really, ultimately, of this book, of how we can be completely be oblivious to the consequences of our actions and our affections to ourself.
But there's still one major flaw about this, is like they can very well be 16 years old, but they have 200 years of contemplation to actually shift their minds, even though they have the presence of, like, you know, being 16 years old. I mean, why I'm just wondering why you made this particular sort of, they decided to be more carefree than you know, it just,
well, I think it gets back to that 17 year old who said, I'm not going to read the history, I just want to read Haley. And it is a state of being. It's a state when you are in a place where things go unobserved. And right now, you could say culturally, we are in a place where we seem to be less observant about the consequences of our actions abroad.
Well, I understand that, but I'm just wondering, though, I would think that if, you know, if you or I had the option to be immortal,
right,
no matter whether we were 40 or 16 or 96, throughout the course of time, that at some point we would say, Jesus, this is boring, just going ahead and living this kind of frivolity, you know? I mean, shouldn't we sort of rethink things? Shouldn't we sort of, like, you know, kind of step away and realize?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. The question is not everyone does that, you know? And you are, I mean, you are asserting something that is a little complicated, which is whether or not they are immortal, or whether or not they are living in what Tennessee Williams used to call infantile omnipotence, is in fact the damage to them so severe that their hyper ego is protecting themselves and allowing them to be oblivious to the world. But what you're talking about is maturity. And so, you know, it brings up a tricky issue about the very end, you know, of what really happens there, you know, and which is, I'd love to talk to you about, but I don't want to give away the end. So, it's, you know, maybe when the mics are dull, because I think you're absolutely right. You're bringing up a very important issue that goes to the heart of its view of humanity, of its view of immortality, and its view of social political constructs. Absolutely. So I agree with you.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Mark, pleasure to chat with you. Thanks
pleasure
so much.
You
gotta be prepared in this day and age. We gotta be prepared for whatever the fuck comes at us. Because we are living revolutionarily. Definitely. You cannot second guess yourself in these days and times. They're gonna throw whatever they can at you. And you gotta be prepared for it. You gotta be prepared for anything.
It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or